a radical notion called charity. To define the word radical, one need look no further than the 13th chapter of St. Paul's first epistle to the Corinthians. It expounds with crystal clarity a concept that stood the whole world on its head, a concept that's in direct conflict with every other concept that has ever or will ever animate human society. It is not merely counterintuitive. By human standards, it's positively irrational. St. Paul is not merely urging us to feel warm and fuzzy about folks in our homes and our communities. He isn't telling us to be tolerant of people who are different from us. He is charging us with a solemn obligation to love and to cherish people he defines as our neighbours as much as we love ourselves. And Paul's definition of the word neighbour encompasses virtually everybody else in the whole wide world. In terms of human wisdom, such a notion is folly. It's not merely an unattainably high standard, it is utterly off the wall. Self-preservation and self-advancement are basic human imperatives. They make us tick. They make us strive to improve our lives and by extension the lives of our nearest and dearest. And because a healthy and prosperous community is usually a prerequisite of our personal well-being, we strive to strengthen and improve our communities as well. To assess just how wacky Paul's concept really is, we need look no further than the society in which he wrote it, the Roman Empire of the 1st century AD. Back then, the Roman Empire was by far the best place in the world to live, at least for all but the most fanatical of nationalists and the lowliest of slaves. It wasn't a democracy, but it was cultured and prosperous and enjoyed an enviably high standard of justice. Yet Roman concepts of human relations were entirely different from anything we'd find acceptable today. Love, for example, was not regarded as a virtue. If anything, it was seen as a weakness. Families were not bound by bonds of affection. Sure, some husbands loved their wives, and some parents loved their children and vice versa, but families were actually held together by legal obligations. Fathers had power of life and death over their children until they decided to emancipate them, and some fathers never emancipated their children. Slavery was an energy source as essential to the Roman Empire as oil and coal are to us today. Slaves weren't people, they were commodities, property that could be used, beaten, sold, and slain at will. The demand for slaves was voracious. So much so, Rome was constantly at war to obtain more of them. Concepts such as mercy and pity were no more regarded as virtues than love. Mercy was largely a political tool used to bind the recipients with bonds of obligation. The idea of being merciful out of a sense of pity would be seen as a weakness. It was a society in which every man was for himself, in which the norm was to grab what you wanted in the realm of sex, money and power, and the devil take the hindmost. It was in this brutal, ruthless, greedy society that Paul preached that the love of mankind is a central tenet of the Christian faith. And to emphasize the fact, he addressed an epistle on the subject to the church located in the most licentious city in the empire, the Church of Corinth. It was a church whose members habitually gorged the food and wine donated for the poor, and in which women flounced into services dressed in provocative clothes, while the men routinely patronized bordellos. Yet Paul's irrational and unworldly doctrine actually transformed the world, and not by a massive upheaval, but by the transformation of one individual human heart at a time. It was embraced by the hard-bitten centurions who commanded Rome's conquering armies. It was embraced by slave owners like Philemon, who welcomed back as a brother his runaway slave Onesimus. Eventually it was embraced by the Roman Empire itself. Christianity was proclaimed the official state religion. Slavery was abolished, along with the brutal gladiatorial games and the sadistic punishment of crucifixion. The transformation of the West was not instantaneous, of course. Self-preservation and self-advancement, even today, remain powerful imperatives. ruthlessness is still a path to power and prosperity. But over two millennia, the embrace of the Christian faith and the virtues it upholds rendered the ruthless, single-minded pursuit of personal wealth and power infamous and disgraceful. Indeed, many of the activities considered quite acceptable in Rome have been proscribed as criminal. Yet today, our self-anointed intelligentsia fashionably scoff at the contention that the Christian faith and Christianity alone transformed Western society. They reject the contention that Paul's doctrine of charity and love was divinely inspired. They claim it springs naturally from the human heart. Indeed, the European community deliberately omitted from its constitution all mention of the debt Europe owes to the Christian faith. Indeed, it is against community law for many categories of workers to so much as mention their Christian faith openly. English courts, like those of the rest of Europe, are facing a growing burden of religious discrimination cases against people who openly profess Christianity. All this in a country where Anglicanism is supposedly the established state religion. Here in America, we're headed in the same direction. Equality and diversity rules threaten Christians in the public sector if they're open about their faith in the workplace. Doctors and nurses face disciplinary charges if colleagues or parents accuse them of proselytizing. Codes of practice penalize Christian teachers and coaches who discuss their beliefs with pupils. Christian members of school and college sports teams are forbidden to pray in public at games and are punished if they do so. Thus, Western society is becoming increasingly like that of ancient Rome. There, refusal to worship the state as supremely divine was a capital offence. There, the legal code allowed parents to dispose of unwanted babies on municipal garbage dumps. Meanwhile, the courts condemned Christians who rescued the abandoned children to die in the arena on trumped-up charges of cannibalism. Americans once uniformly regarded such practices as infanticide with revulsion. Yet today, state legislatures are debating such laws, laws that authorize mothers to kill unwanted newborns. In New York and New Hampshire, passage of such legislation was greeted with cheers. For the newborn baby, the God-given right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is thus no longer guaranteed. All Americans are claimed to be born equal, but increasingly, it seems, newborn Americans are born less equal than others. At the turn of the last century, the philosopher George Santayana warned that those who did not learn from history would be doomed to repeat it. America's self-anointed elite, however, seem oblivious to the lessons of recent world history, namely that absent Christianity, efforts to improve the human lot tend to have tragic results. They seem blithely unaware that Vladimir Lenin and Joseph Stalin did not set out with the goal of becoming hated monsters. Just like Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, Mao Zedong and their fellow murderous despots, they expected to be hailed as the benefactors of mankind. Our present state of depravity was chillingly articulated by the corporate chieftain who famously told his shareholders, "If you want loyalty, get a dog." His words call to mind those of the philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who long ago in the 16th century warned that absent the Christian faith, life here would be solitary, nasty, brutish, and short.